In the name of the Father, and of the Son, and of the Holy Spirit. In 1832, a young diocesan priest in France named Prosper Guéranger went in with five of his priest friends and bought a ruined Benedictine abbey called Solesmes. And there they set about restoring monastic life in its fullness and celebrating the sacred liturgy in all of its fullness. Now remember that by the 19th century, when most people all over the place went to Mass, the priest was up at the altar saying the prayers quietly in Latin, usually as fast as possible. Okay, sometimes priests and altar boys would get into contests to see who could finish first. And then the people, very frequently, were in the pews going about their own private devotions. And if there was any music at all, it was much like the operas that they went to hear in the concert hall. They would hear Tosca in the concert hall and hear a mass setting which was based on the same opera. It was at Solesmes that they started to sing the mass once again in Gregorian chant. Did you know it was actually kind of a lost art for centuries? And they celebrated the mass in a reverent and in an unhurried manner. They also began to study the liturgy. Well, why do we celebrate Mass the way we do? And what is the history of why we celebrate the way we do? It was the birth of something called the liturgical movement. Now, all over Europe, monasteries and convents began to do the same thing. And soon lay people started to flock to these abbeys to see the liturgical ceremonies done with great love and devotion and hear the chant sung so beautifully. And of course, that began to raise a lot of questions. You know, they go back to their parishes and they'd be like, well, Father, why do you want to get us in and out of here as soon as possible? And, you know, why do we have this horrifying music? You know, why can't you be like the monks at Solesmes, where they take their time and it's beautiful and lovely? And so the monks began to teach the lay people who came how to pray the Mass instead of just praying at Mass. They told them that they shouldn't just come to Mass and sit there like a bump on a log, but how to actively participate in the Mass. And the monks were convinced that restoring that virile liturgical spirit would renew not just the church, but the entire world. Now, at first, there were parish priests all over the world. You know, we tend to be very cynical sometimes. And the parish priest said, well, you know what? That's great. That's fine and dandy for monks and nuns, but that is not going to work for people in the world. It's just not going to happen. But little by little, priests like Pius Parsch in Vienna and Martin Hellriegel in St. Louis, Missouri, priests in the most unlikely places started to show that the laity could enter into the Mass just as much as the monks did and richly benefit from it. A lot of the early 20th century was spent trying to get people to really understand what went on at Mass and to make it the center of their life. The liturgical movement didn't reach everywhere, but it did affect many places. Now, as the 20th century continued on, some priests and lay people suggested that, well, maybe even more people would benefit from the Mass if the rites and ceremonies and even the language of the Mass were simplified and made closer to the people. The idea was that the liturgy had to be reformed, and that liturgical reform which was just something talked about for decades, started to gain steam in 1951 when Pope Pius XII allowed Mass in the evening. We'd never had Mass after noon for centuries and centuries and centuries and centuries. And so all of this began this kind of these changes, this liturgical reform, and it culminated in 1970 when Pope Paul VI issued an entirely new rite of Mass, which almost everywhere replaced the ancient rite that Catholics had known for centuries. Now, I don't want you to get me wrong or misunderstand me. Okay? There was a lot of good that was accomplished in the liturgical reform. Okay? I think that most people who go to Mass, I mean, they really want to understand the Mass. They want to know what's going on. They want to actively participate, when before, many people just went out of obligation. I'm a Catholic. We go to Mass. That's what we do. And I'll be there and I'll warm a bench, but I'm not going to pay any attention to what's going on. Okay? Sometimes there's still some people like that. We pray for them. Okay? But at the same time, though, certain aspects of the liturgical reform were advanced that in hindsight might not have been such a good idea after all. Now, some of these things were done because it was said, well, this is how it was done in the ancient church, so we're actually going to go back to the authentic tradition. That was the scholarship of the time, but now we know that a lot of that just was not really the case. I'll give you an example. As early as 1917, people began to say that the early Christians celebrated Mass facing the people. And this idea gained so much steam that by the 1960s, priests almost everywhere were celebrating the Mass facing the people. And they were doing so because they thought that they were going back to something that was even more traditional, more ancient. But now we know that that really wasn't the case at all. Now we know that in the early church, Christians faced east at Mass. And the position of the celebrant at the altar was to reflect the east. It wasn't a matter of being towards the people or away from the people. Because, remember that the east, the sun comes rising from the east, like the risen Lord would come from the east, like the sun. And it seems kind of strange to us, but, you know, there were places in which the people would even turn their backs to the altar at the Eucharistic prayer if that meant they could face east. It's very strange for us to think of that. I can't imagine that happening now, but that was the real case of how the liturgy was celebrated in antiquity. Other things were done because it was felt that some of the traditional practices of the church were just too foreign for modern people to understand. For example, there was a custom in the ancient liturgy that the altar server, every time he handed something to the priest or took it back from him, would kiss his hand and then the thing that he was giving or taking back from him. And a lot of people now see that and they're like, what on earth is that? That's just weird. Okay? And so some of these customs seemed a little bit strange for people in different times and places. Now, Vatican II, okay, remember that great council which was held from 1962 to 1965, said that the liturgy is the source and summit of Christian life. The liturgy is the source and summit of Christian life. The entire liturgical reform was crafted to make sure that every Catholic understood that. But 50 years later, many of us are asking, do we not throw the baby out with the bathwater? Do we stop doing things that we really just didn't understand, which, if we understood them better, might be very meaningful? Even Cardinal Ratzinger, who is to become Pope Benedict XVI, said, maybe it is time for a reform of the reform. Of course, for him, though, the original reform had been dictated by the clergy and forced upon the people. A lot of these changes, you know, came down, and Father said, this is what we're going to do now, and whether you like it or not, this is what's happening. And some of the people, they loved the changes, and then other people hated the changes. So Pope Benedict was insistent that the new liturgical movement, this reform of the reform, not make the same mistake. That it had to be introduced gradually, slowly, by way of example, and accompanied by good, solid teaching of the faith. His teachings on the sacred liturgy and his personal example of celebrating the mystery of faith have inspired many a younger generation of priests and laypeople who bring with them a renewed love for the Mass. Now, of course, you know just as well as I do, this is no secret, that you know, nowadays you can hardly go from one parish to the next without sometimes thinking that you're in a different religion. Right? You know, so often I have people who, you know, come back to Prince of Peace after being on vacation for a while. And they're like, Father, you're not going to believe what we saw at Mass down in, you know, wherever it was. And then they tell these very strange stories of things that they saw. And so, unfortunately, there's a lot of confusion. And then there are those who are afraid that the church is trying to go back before Vatican II, that the church is trying to go backwards. But in reality, the new liturgical movement is a return to the sources of the liturgy. To get back to not some ideal point in time, as if, you know, 1958 or 1570 or 1054 or 313 or whatever year you want to choose was when it was really good for the church and for the liturgy. Is to return to the reality of the Christian mystery we celebrate. In far too many places, we've watched as the liturgy has lost a sense of the sacred, where the Mass has become all about the community and not about God. And some people kind of like that. You know, they think that that's the way the Mass should be. But everywhere this has actually happened, vocations to the priesthood and religious life and Catholic practice have plummeted. But where a sense of the sacred has been restored, where the Mass is truly about Jesus Christ and not about us, vocations flourish and the practice of the faith comes alive. Now, the point of this sermon series is very simple. We go to Mass every Sunday, week after week, for years. And it's such a part of our lives that, you know, we hardly stop to think about it. But how much do we really know about why we do what we do at Mass? Not just the history of it, but the theology behind it. This sermon series is not about justifying why we do things at Prince of Peace the way that we do them. It's an opportunity to look up close and personal at the liturgy, which is where we meet Christ. I'll share with you tonight why this is so important to me and why I'm so excited about this sermon series. When I was 12 years old, I walked into a Catholic church for the first time. And as soon as I walked into the building, I knew that there was something different about it. It was truly the house of God and the gate of heaven. I knew with absolute clarity, like I have never known about anything else since, that I had to be a Catholic and that I had to be a priest. Now, I had absolutely no idea what that meant, but I knew with absolute clarity that that is where my calling was to be. I stayed in the church, and I saw the Mass for the first time. Now, those of you who are cradled Catholics, you know, maybe it's hard for you to realize what a shock and awe moment something like that is when you're raised as a Baptist in South Carolina. Okay? You see this, you're like, what on earth is this? This is interesting. Okay? But of course, I had no idea what was going on. I'll tell you a fun story. So I'm sitting there and I'm seeing all these people that are coming into church, and I'm seeing them touch one of their knees to the ground. So I'm like, okay, well, you know, the old saying is, when in Rome, do as the Romans do. So I guess I need to do that. So I'm like, okay, everyone else is doing it. So I get up and I put my knees on the ground. But of course, I didn't realize it was towards the tabernacle where Jesus was. So I did it toward the door. But the problem is, I was at the pew right next to one of the doors. And so this poor woman was trying to get in and didn't see me there, and then tripped right over me and fell into the pew. And she said, "What in the are you doing?" And I said, "I have no idea." Okay. Had a lot to learn, still have a lot to learn. Even though the Mass was in English and I understood the words, I didn't understand what was going on and why. But I knew that whatever was going on, there was something true, good, and beautiful, and that I had experienced God in a special way. The Mass enchanted me. And to this day, 24 years later, I'm constantly discovering more about this amazing thing that we Catholics do every Sunday. And one of my parishes, a parishioner, came up to me after Mass and said, "You know, I know every priest says Mass all the time, but for you, the Mass is everything, isn't it? I've never seen a priest so into Mass as you." It was the most wonderful compliment I've ever received in my life. I love the Mass because I love Jesus. And I love you too. And that's why I want to share with you why the Mass is so lovable and why it is so awesome and majestic. The famous English writer, Father Frederick Faber, was fond of saying, "The Mass is the most beautiful thing this side of heaven." Saint Jean-Marie Vianney, the patron saint of parish priests, said, "If we really understood the Mass, we would die of joy." I want us to discover the Mass so well that I have a whole bunch of funerals that we'll have to celebrate because you've all been sent to Jesus. Okay, I'm just joking. Okay? And Padre Pio, "It would be easier for the world to survive without the Son than without Holy Mass." I want you to accompany me on these next few weeks before Lent as we go through the Mass in slow motion. And my hope is that after these few weeks, you will never pray the Mass the same way again.